It's a tremendous pleasure to be able to address you on a matter of common concern on both sides of the Atlantic. I'm going to be giving these three lectures on the ethics of political communication in our current highly polarized times. Most of the empirical information I'm presenting is drawn from the case of the United States, but I invite you all to consider the situation in the UK and parallel developments there. I had actually prepared a whole bunch of slides looking at the UK situation and in particular controversies over Brexit, but then I realized the talk was getting way too long, and so I said, okay, I'm just going to stick to the stuff that I know the best and invite you to contribute your thoughts about political discourse in the UK. The first lecture is simply going to be diagnostic, and indeed even parts of the second lecture will delve more deeply into diagnosis. And then the second and third lectures, I will be talking about solutions and how we actually can recover constructive possibilities for communicating our moral concerns regarding political matters. But right now, we're just going to focus on what has gone wrong with contemporary political discourse. Of course, what has gone wrong is not even confined just to the United States and the UK. We see this similar problems of political discourse arising in many of the democracies around the world, including India, Hungary, Turkey, Brazil, Poland. It's happening in a lot of places. I'm going to first locate two problems of political discourse in today's democracies. One has to do with the articulation of false claims, what I'm calling disinformation, misleading claims. They're not necessarily false, but they mislead people, propaganda of various sorts. Now, what's important here is not simple falsehood. People often err. What's problematic is when people are making claims that are not evidence-based, they're not merely erroneous, but they're trying to mislead, or maybe they believe something, but they're not basing their claims on evidence and critical reflection. And indeed, these claims are often impervious to correction, and so I'm going to abbreviate this as double down dogmatism. So someone says something with political content and other people rush to correct and point to counter evidence, and then the person just digs in their heels and insists that they're right, and all this supposed counter evidence is just fake news or something like that. So it's that dogmatism, that digging in the heels, even in the face of counter evidence that I'm interested in. So that's problem number one. And problem number two is discourse that isn't fact based at all, but it amounts to trolling and insults or shaming people for what they say. And this discourse happens on both the left and the right. I think right wing discourse leans more towards the trolling end, left wing more towards the shaming end, especially mass shaming and phenomena such as cancel culture and so-called political correctness. And the difficulty here is that discourse then no longer is about facts. It actually displaces measured evidence-based discussion of problems and solutions, which supposedly our democracies are supposed to be helping us arrive at. Now I'm just going to focus on the first problem, problem one, and identify two types of double-down dogmatic claim that are very common in democracies today. So these are purportedly factual claims, but in fact aren't based on evidence or are profoundly misleading in some way. Two types of such claim. One has to do with scientific claims about risks. So we see, for instance, people insisting that climate change is a hoax, or that vaccines cause autism. Those are popular on both sides of the Atlantic. The second type of claim are claims about governments, political figures, establishment institutions such as the mainstream media and the press and universities, and also claims about identity groups these days, especially concerning immigrants, but not at all confined to immigrants. So such claims, I'll just give you some examples. The idea that there are American towns that are living under Sharia law because of the concentration of Muslims in those towns, or the claims that have been made by some media in the UK and France that there are Muslim no-go areas in Paris and London. Pizzagate, I don't know if that reached the UK. Did you know that Hillary Clinton was running a pedophilia ring out of an actual pizza parlor? You didn't know that. But I'm sure you've heard about birtherism, the idea that Obama was actually not born in the United States, but in Kenya or something like that. Over in the UK here, Boris Johnson made his journalistic career by making up fake EU regulations. So many such claims that the EU actually had to put up a web page refuting them all, which still exists, by the way. You can look it up. And the claim of many politicians whenever journalists point out that they're lying, it's all just dismissed as fake news. I want us to step back from the truth value of these claims and think about what their political function is in our democracies today. The point of making these double-down dogmatic claims is to promote distrust and resentment. That's their function, their political function. To make people distrust the media and mainstream science, that is actual empirical, evidence-based science and medicine. To promote distrust of mainstream journalism, the kind of journalism that's actually trying to get out the truth. To promote distrust of establishment governing institutions and politicians, politicians from centrist parties. To promote resentment of marginalized identity groups, most prominently today immigrants, but not at all exclusively confined to immigrants. All kinds of marginalized identity groups, also including gay and lesbian people, non-white people, sometimes Muslims. And to promote distrust of opposing political parties and leaders. So there's been a lot of this discourse happening in the past several years in the United States. Actually, we have an entire news network, Fox News, that's been spreading these claims for decades. And it's working. So this is American data. We can see here that public trust in government is near historic lows. Now, I can't show that this distrust is primarily caused by these kinds of claims, but I would be extremely surprised if it's not a major factor driving declining trust in government. Declining trust in the media. So that dark green line reflects Republican trust in the mass media. And you can see it's now only 14% of Republicans trust media sources like the New York Times, 14%. Democrats are a little bit higher, but even they've been slipping. Democrats, still a majority, actually trust sources like the New York Times, but it's only 51%, bare majority. Republicans now believe that colleges and universities have on net a negative impact on the United States. And look at that sharp change there, which is roughly when Trump started running for president. It's a really dramatic shift, a really dramatic decline in trust. And that is leading also to dramatic defunding of public universities at the state level. You might have heard, for instance, that the Republican governor of Alaska has cut the University of Alaska's budget in half overnight. Here we can see also public confidence in vaccinations has also been declining since 2008. There's a lot more of things like this. I had a lot more slides. What are the sources of double down dogmatist claims? Well, there's all kinds of sources. We have fake news sites originating, many of them originating in Russia and Eastern Europe. Some of them funded by the Russian government, but some of them just out for commercial interests. They're making money off ads. We have some professional conspiracy theorists in the United States, Alex Jones, who in response to a mass shooting of school children in Connecticut, spread the conspiracy theory that the aggrieved parents were crisis actors who were hired to discredit the fact that Americans own and use an awful lot of guns. We have various alt-right agitators and media people in broadcasting and social media. But what I'm going to be focusing on primarily today are populist politicians, mostly what I'm calling right populists. Of course, there are also left-wing populist politicians. But populist politicians, whether of the left or of the right, tend to make a lot of double-down dogmatist claims, and I'm going to explain to you why. But first, I will give you the winner in the contest of who makes the most such claims, the President of the United States. The Washington Post has a running tab of how many false claims that Trump has dug in his heels on. And as of August 5th, it was up to 12,019. So let's keep in mind, every politician lies. I'm not saying that there are completely 100% honest politicians. But here's the difference. For most politicians, when they're caught out in a lie, or often it's just a mere error, they will back down. So for instance, a classic case of this was Senator Harry Reid, who claimed that when Romney was running for president, that Romney didn't pay a dime in taxes. And I'm sure that Reid knew that this was false, but he did it basically to force Romney to reveal his tax returns, which he did in order to show that he did pay taxes. They still paid very low taxes for a billionaire. But Romney's point here, he immediately backed down. His point was just to flesh out the truth, that is to get Romney to reveal his tax situation. Whereas Trump has carried on and on about the claim, he spent years claiming that Obama was born in Kenya. Then he backed off after he won the election, but now he's back saying it again. He claimed that Obama founded ISIS, that Mexico is sending rapists to the United States. And when he's called out, especially for his hostile claims about immigrants, he digs in his heels and even makes up more lies about immigrants. So my claim is that most political double-down dogmatism today is populist. Not all of it, but an awful lot of it, and the stuff of immense political consequence, tends to be coming out of the mouths of populist leaders and populist media people. So that requires me to define what populism is, and I define it as follows. It's a style of politics in representative democracies that deploys narratives of elite corruption, betrayal, and humiliation of the people to frame the meanings of political events and to mobilize voters. So populism here, I'm defining in terms of a style of discourse that is used to mobilize voters and win elections, to win power. There are both left populists and right populists, and the fundamental distinction between the two depends on how they identify the elites versus the people, who are the enemies of the people. Left populism has a two-group theory. There are the corrupt elites, or the rich, and they've betrayed the morally decent real people who are workers and often the poor or the middle class. Okay, so you have a two-group populist discourse here. You have the rich versus everybody else. And left populists tend to advocate some kind of socialism, usually very poorly grounded in economics, and then you get catastrophes like Venezuela. In the advanced democracies today, though, most populist parties and leaders are right populists, they're right-wing. And there you have a more complex three-group construction and style of understanding the meanings of political phenomena. So on this narrative, the right-wing populist narrative, corrupt elites have betrayed the morally decent people by unjustly favoring undeserving others. So the elites are rich cosmopolitans, highly educated city dwellers, intellectuals, experts of various sorts, mainstream establishment parties and media. They're the ones to be blamed for betraying the morally decent people, who are basically middle-class people of whatever the dominant ethnicity, religion, or whatever dominant identity prevails in the society in question. And the elites are betraying the real people by unjustly favoring undeserving others. And again, the undeserving others could vary, but they include things like foreigners and immigrants, despised racial or religious groups, LGBT people, the poor, a variety of groups here, but those tend to be the most common ones. And so the upshot then of right-wing populism is to promote various forms of nationalism and bigotry. To get more refined about the right-wing populist narrative, we can take a look at the very important work by sociologist Arlie Hochschild, who wrote a wonderful book called Strangers in Their Own Land about Trump voters in the state of Louisiana. We also have very important parallel evidence in the UK of white working class voters, British voters, who voted for Brexit. So Hochschild describes the mentality of her subjects as follows, and she actually told this narrative to her subjects and asked them, is this how you feel? And they say, this is exactly how I feel. So she has direct confirmation from her subjects that this is how they're thinking about their political world. There you are, patiently standing in the middle of a long line, stretching towards the horizon where the American dream awaits. But then there are all these people who are cutting in line ahead of you. They're black, they're beneficiaries of affirmative action or welfare, career-driven women pushing into jobs they never had before, immigrants. And there Obama is. Here she was writing when Obama was still president. Obama's waving the line cutters forward. It's these elites who are letting all of these marginalized people cut in line, cut in front of the really deserving people who've been patiently waiting and working hard to reach the goal that was promised to them by American politics, that you'll win the American dream, you'll be successful and wealthy and respected. So these elites, like Obama, they're helping the line cutters. He and his liberal backers have removed the shame from taking government benefits. The government is redistributing your hard-earned money to the undeserving. Now, in some places, you find even contradictory attributes assigned to the undeserving. So in many countries, populist leaders, many Western countries, populist leaders are claiming that immigrants are simultaneously lazing on hammocks, living off welfare benefits, and taking your jobs. So they're being very busy. So who are the elites in right populism? Well, we have a list that's pretty common across the democracies. They include highly educated people, especially university faculty. There's enormous resentment being whipped up against people like me, not only because I'm a faculty member, but also I'm a humanist, which gives me an extra minus. And I'm a woman. Oh, I have so many counts against me, right? How come I'm there, instead of a man? And the source of that, there's resentment here, right? It's like university professors are looking down their noses at low education populace. So the fundamental division here between populist voters and the people they resent is an educational division rather than a sheer wealth division. Indeed, the median Trump voter actually has above average income. They make about $70,000 a year, whereas the median household income in the United States is around $50,000 a year. So actually they're a little bit richer, but they have lower education on average. So these are non-college educated, but often quite financially successful people. They might be running small businesses. Cosmopolitans are also enemies on this view. And the reason is because they're friendly to diverse people. They like immigrants, they like blacks, they're interested in engaging with Muslims and so forth, gay, lesbian people, trans people, and so forth. Civil servants also are objects of populist resentment. I know this actually from a student of mine who grew up in Huron County, Michigan. Michigan can be represented as a hand. He's right on the thumb. A very rural county, it went overwhelmingly for Trump. And he reported to me directly, he was writing a thesis on 19th century American populism, but he said where he grew up, nobody thought civil servants really did anything. Like, they're not real workers. Real working is working with your hands. Maybe you're a farmer, or a carpenter, or a plumber, something like that. Civil servants, office work, it's not real work. All they're doing is handing out benefits to undeserving people. Bankers and financiers are also despised elites. Often there's an implicitly anti-Semitic side to this. Soros is the common enemy of right-wing populists in virtually every country. Educated women seeking traditionally male jobs. There's also a strong misogynistic streak here. And liberals, that is American terminology, liberals, the establishment left, because those people favor the line cutters. And finally, mainstream journalists. That is, people who actually call out populist leaders for their lies, they're also despised and resented. So what I'm stressing here is the way right populist discourse is activating certain kinds of emotions. This is really critical that we have to focus on this. What emotions are actually getting activated by this discourse? It's a very emotional style of politics. Now, all politics, of course, does appeal to people's emotions, and I'm the last person in the world to claim that emotions are irrational. Often they have quite a lot of sense, but if emotions are being activated by double down dogmatist claims, his misleading and false claims, then those emotions are going to be misled as well. Key right populist emotions include resentment. A narrative of betrayal and unfairness is going to make people resentful. Humiliation. Populist voters feel humiliated because these elites are looking down on them. They feel that they've lost status because of who's on top now in the culture wars. Fear is a huge emotion in populist discourse. Fear of losing something really important. So on the far right, we have, for instance, replacement discourse, that whites are going to be replaced by non-white immigrants. But there's lesser kinds of fears too, not just of replacement or white genocide as tagged on Twitter, but all kinds of losses of employment, losses of respect and so forth, the fear that that's slipping away. And finally, nostalgia. Another really interesting emotion. Trump says, make America great again. He's appealing to older voters who have warm memories for better times in the past. And in particular, times when the white working class was demographically and politically dominant. Indeed, you can do experiments in polling and find that white voters become more right-wing and receptive to populist messages if they're reminded that, according to the United States Census, whites will be a minority, in the next decade or so in the United States. Nostalgia also when whites were the center of attention in cultural representation. I've heard populists complain, they turn on the TV now, American TV, and they see people who are Latino, Asian, and so forth, and they feel like, who are these people? Why are these people being shown? Even though, in fact, TV is just reflecting the increasing diversity of America. A lot of nostalgia for a time when you didn't need a college education to have a stable middle class status, to not be part of the precariat. And nostalgia for a time when one was unquestionably respected, when people wouldn't look down their noses. Now, nostalgia, like all constructs based on memory, need not be entirely accurate. As people age, they tend to confuse what happened. I'm not claiming that this is dementia, it's just that every older person, when they look back to when they were a young adult, everything seemed promising back then. They're young and healthy and open opportunities, and they got enormous energy. It's only natural that older people will look back at the times of their youth and remember that vigor, that optimism. And they might even confuse it a little bit with other differences of the society back then. I think it's completely natural, actually, for older people to feel nostalgia for eras in the past. So let's now consider populist discourse and how it is activating the emotions in question and also satisfying these emotions. So this is important, is that populist discourse is both activating these emotions of resentment and fear and so forth, but also giving ways for people to feel satisfied, to have those emotions vindicated and satisfied. So, and indeed, problem one, the problem of double down dogmatism over false claims, is all about activating the emotions. And problem number two, about trolling and insults, that's all about delivering emotional satisfaction. Okay, so let's see how this works. Problem one, remember, was about double down dogmatist claims that are false or misleading. Okay, And those claims are advanced in political discourse in order to activate the emotions I just named, especially fear and resentment. So they have to have a fact, they have to purport to be factual. Usually they're consistent causal claims about what's causing what. To activate and justify ethnocentric feelings, feelings of that the whole, that one's identity group has been humiliated, to activate the group's resentment of diverse others, fear of diverse others, and also nostalgia for better times in the past. The second problem that I opened this talk with has to do with emotional, with things like trolling and insults. And that's all about emotion satisfaction, right? You can activate resentment, but then you can also satisfy this in a discourse of vengeance, for instance. Symbolic insults is taking down those people who look down their noses at you. Okay? I'm going to call this kind of discourse identity expressive discourse. And it has several different types. So one type I'm calling symbolic self-defense. So in this type of identity expressive discourse, somebody is hearing claims made by somebody who's not a member of the populist group, and they hear an insult in what's being said. And so they react with symbolic self-defense, okay, of their own status. They're standing up for their own group against perceived insults coming from elites, from enemies of the people. Secondly, we have a kind of discourse I'm going to call symbolic aggression against perceived threats. This could involve things like hate speech against despised and marginalized others. Hate speech, for instance, against immigrants. Very aggressive kinds of discourse to fend off feared others. And thirdly, what I'm calling symbolic revenge. And these consist in various kinds of takedowns of the elites who are conceived of as treasonous and corrupt. Now, here's the critical thing about identity expressive discourse, is that often in form, it seems to be making empirical claims. Okay, so it seems like, oh, people are just asserting facts, or what they take to be facts. But my argument is that often this discourse, even when it ostensibly seems to be making factual assertions, in fact is simply guided by status positioning, not evidence. It's not even pretending really to be guided by the evidence. Its function in discourse is symbolic positioning of the in-group against the out-group, defending it against emotion, and raising the in-group, the populist group, above those who are conceived of as enemies or diverse others who really should be beneath them. So my claim here is that the payoffs of identity expressive discourse are symbolic. They're not material, they're not instrumental. This discourse is not attempting to advance claims that would be helpful in any kind of instrumental action. Rather, the payoffs of this discourse are symbolic and embodied in the discourse itself. If you successfully pull off an insult, the satisfaction is right there that you got away with it, right? So I'll give you some illustrations of this kind of discourse. Here's a case of symbolic self-defense. How many of you have seen these side-by-side photographs? A lot of you, yeah. So that was news that came across to the UK. So this is a famous pair of photographs that was tweeted out, I believe, by somebody in the National Park Service. This is the Washington Mall, where every presidential inauguration takes place. The picture on the left is a photograph of the crowds at Donald Trump's inauguration, and the picture on the right is the crowds at Obama's inauguration 4 years earlier in 2012. A couple of political scientists, Schaffner and Lux, showed these photographs without captions to Trump voters and asked the simple factual question, which photograph depicts more people in it? It's just an empirical claim, which one has more people? And they discovered that 15% of Trump voters insisted that the left-hand photograph contains more people. Okay, so that's ostensibly a factual claim, but I think it's preposterous to understand what people are saying, these Trump voters who say the left-hand photo has more people. It's absurd to impute to them the literal belief that there are more people in the left-hand photograph. Rather, this is a classic example of identity expressive discourse. What Trump voters were perceiving was that these pointy-headed intellectuals, these university professors from some snotty university are showing these photos, which everyone by then knew what they were of, even though they were uncaptioned. These liberal professors are out to insult Trump voters. And so, what do you do in that situation? You rise up in self-defense of your group. You dig in your heels and you say, the left one has more people. Okay, so on this model, asserting some claim P is a way of repudiating an outgroup insult. You perceive the person who's presenting this is really just trying to insult you by claiming that Trump isn't that popular or not nearly as popular as that illegitimate president who's really born in Kenya. Okay, and basically what's happening with this kind of symbolic self-defense is that the 15% of Trump voters who dug in their heels on the left-hand photo are basically rejecting the terms of the out-group's play for dominance. They're hearing this as an insult, and they're repudiating the insult. They're expressing loyalty to their group, the Trump supporters, and they're expressing distrust and hostility towards those pointy-headed, snobby university professors. Essentially, what they're doing is they're saying, I'm not yielding any ground to those professors, right? In a status competition, I'm sticking with my group, I'm standing up for my group. Right, and not accepting the terms of this insulting discourse. Here's how symbolic aggression works. There's a famous case that happened a little while ago. You can find it on YouTube. A woman was harassed by a white man in a public park for wearing a t-shirt with the flag of Puerto Rico on it. And he objected that you're in America. Well, actually, Puerto Rico is a U.S. territory, and Puerto Ricans are American citizens. But he felt, no, if you are at least in the 50 United States, Puerto Rico is not a state. It's a territory, a national territory. And his claim was, if you're in the 50 United States of America, you have no business wearing a flag or displaying the flag of Puerto Rico. He started harassing her. She was having a picnic in the park. And he came up to her very aggressively. And she started doing a video of this on her cell phone because she was feeling very frightened and intimidated by him. He was saying things like, you're not gonna change us, you know that, right? We're not going to be changed by people like you. And then he asked, are you a United States citizen? In fact, she was. The Puerto Ricans are U.S. citizens. But then you shouldn't be wearing that, the flag of Puerto Rico. It's okay to wear the flag of Florida or North Carolina or what have you, but not Puerto Rico. So here you see aggression. Now, what I think is interesting about this aggression, it's quite, I think, evidently an expression of fear. You're not changing us. That is, he fears people, Latinos, basically, and he perceived her as an immigrant, even though in fact she's an American citizen, and all Puerto Ricans are American citizens. But still, that was that fear, and fear inspires a fight or flight response, but instead of running away, he's fighting, symbolically, discursively. He's being aggressive to show that she's not going to take away anything he cherishes. She's not going to take away America from his group, from him and his group, white people. Here's an example of symbolic humiliation and vengeance. Were you aware of the fact that Obama was a gay, male, cocaine-addicted prostitute? You didn't know that. You can get this off the web. I mean, I did not Photoshop this. I'm just pulling it off the web. I think it would be preposterous to suppose that opponents of Obama literally believe this. No, it's just an insult, right? And it's classic feature of insults that you can make purportedly factual claims that in fact have nothing, they're not assertions of belief in any sense at all. Like, everyone knows that. They're simply insults by representing someone in a discreditable light. One takes them down symbolically, whether or not the claim is true or evidence-based. There are other ways of engaging in symbolic humiliation and vengeance. You might have seen, for instance, a GIF of President Trump in a wrestling ring taking down a person with a cube representing CNN, right, the news network, the centrist mainstream news network. Here's another example, which isn't even factual, but it's clearly a matter of symbolic vengeance. Lock her up, one of Trump's famous cries during his campaign rallies, calling for Hillary Clinton to be imprisoned. And he got then his supporters at his campaign rallies to be chanting that. So how is this working? What's going on? We can understand this discourse, this populist identity expressive discourse, in terms of what I'll call the populist economy of esteem. The line metaphor captures it perfectly. The economy of esteem within populism is zero sum. It's all about positional competition. Right, just like in the line, you're in the front of the line, and if somebody cuts in front, then you have lost, you're behind now. In pure positional competition, one person can win only if the other side loses. So it's entirely zero sum, and the in-group wins, the populist in-group wins. Their winning is constituted by the outgroup losing, by the elites losing, and by the marginalized groups losing. Stick both of those groups at the back of the line, at the back of the honor line or the esteem line. Now, once you buy into that style of discourse, there's no possibility of cooperation or compromise, either with elites or with less advantaged groups, because politics is a zero-sum game. And it's all about esteem. It's not about cooperating to deliver material goods of any kind. It's about who's better than who. So in populist discourse, which is focused on issues of humiliation and esteem and honor, symbolic discourse tends to displace evidence-based problem-solving and any kind of consequence-sensitive policy discourse. Even if it takes the form of empirical claim, that's really not what it's about or how it's functioning. Now, having said that, there are left-wing responses to populist discourse, and I'm going to be criticizing left-wing responses as well. I think they actually end up fanning the flames of destructive political discourse. So one common left response is mass shaming for statements that are perceived as bigoted, for instance. And this is what is known as political correctness. Famous case, Justine Sacco tweeted out, "I'm going to Africa, hope I don't get AIDS. Just kidding, I'm white." Okay, a very famous case. She turned off her cell phone. This went viral on Twitter, and thousands of people denounced her as a horrible racist. She's asleep on the plane. She turns on her phone when she lands in South Africa, and she discovers that everyone hates her now, and she's fired and has to go into hiding for years and has a near nervous breakdown because of the mass shaming of this event. Here's another example. The delegitimation of right populists. Classic case, Hillary Clinton quoting Michelle Obama. You can put half of Trump's supporters into what I call the basket of deplorables. They're racist, sexist, homophobic, xenophobic, Islamophobic, you name it. And he, Trump, has lifted them up. Some of these folks, they're irredeemable. So they're illegitimate, just as the populists say that elites are illegitimate and corrupt. Now the problem with this, there are many problems with these types of responses, mass shaming and delegitimation, is that basically they're just expressing reciprocal antagonism towards attacks, populist attacks, and that's just fueling the destructive features of populist politics. It fuels populist distrust of elites. If Hillary says, "You're deplorable and illegitimate," well, why would those people ever trust her? How could you trust somebody who thinks you're deplorable? It's not going to happen. It also fuels populist leaders' repudiation of elite norms by insisting that we're the good ones. Right, we're the serious, sober, responsible people. It actually helps populist leaders show solidarity with their supporters by denouncing those very norms that elites uphold. So if the elite norm is sober truth-telling, populist leaders will repudiate that by engaging in shameless lying, and that's a form of symbolic aggression. An excellent case in point is Corey Lewandowski, a former Trump campaign supporter who's now toying with the idea of running for the Senate, who recently said, just a couple weeks ago, "I have no obligation to be honest with the media," and he boasted about that, right? Utterly shameless lying is something now that he finds like he has an absolute entitlement to, because the mainstream media, they're worthless, they're illegitimate. Here's another problem with left-wing responses to right-wing populist identity expressive discourse. These expressions of reciprocal antagonism adopt some of the same destructive features that populist politics runs on. It gives in to the framing of politics as essentially about positional esteem, competition, who's better than who, who's more virtuous, who's more vicious. And once you devolve into that style of discourse, that just displaces attempts to find common ground as a basis for exploring solutions to shared problems. If the other side is the problem, what point is there trying to seek shared solutions? What point is there even in talking with deplorable people? After all, they're racist, sexist, homophobic, and so forth. Right? They're deplorable. The other side is the problem. Mass public shaming ends up suppressing the communication needed to construct democratic solutions to core concerns of the left, such as racism. Think about it. A lot of people, they say things that express denigrating racial stereotypes, but these stereotypes so saturate the culture that people say them, and they're not even fully aware often of what they're saying or how insulting it is. They just take it for granted that this is the way things are. And then maybe they're subject to mass shaming, like Justine Sacco, and other people observe this mass shaming and see how it ruined her life. And what they think is, wow, this is a minefield. Better not talk about this. I don't want to talk about this at all. Fear of shaming then leads to self-censorship. And even well-meaning people who are not fully woke by left standards just want to avoid the issue because they don't want to be subject to a mass pile-on where they're denounced as a bigot. But that self-censorship leads to resentment of the left. Those sanctimonious people, like, I'm just articulating what to me seems common sense. And like now I'm being made to feel ashamed about that, right? And so there's a lot of resentment about this kind of behavior. Resentment of the left, resentment of elites. Here's another problem. Ann Case and Angus Deaton, two very distinguished economists, did some research, and they found shockingly that middle-aged whites in the United States have an increasing death rate. This is almost unprecedented in the rich economies of the world to see increasing death rates. Every other group has declining death rates. So they published a very famous paper about it. And the response they got was, how dare you work on whites? That was coming from the left. Now, it is true that blacks are, on average, much worse off on the mortality figures than whites are. But the trend is quite shocking. All racial groups except whites have seen declining mortality rates. And even if whites are better off in the aggregate, they're getting worse off, and the only group that's getting worse off. And so we do have a problem here, because when the left excludes some groups from sympathy, that itself is undermining egalitarian values that the left wants to uphold. The left wants to be all-inclusive and universal. But if you say some groups' health problems are not worthy of attention, and who's even looking at it, you have a problem. So here you can see this graph comes from Case and Deaton's data, and they found that middle-aged whites, that's the red line, actually are showing increasing mortality. This is all-cause mortality. This is white non-Hispanics who are not, they have high school education or less, not college educated. So it is a narrow demographic group, it's true, but still, these are Trump voters. Okay, white, non-Hispanics, with high school education or less, no college, okay, and middle age. This actually is very characteristic of a Trump demographic. And black non-Hispanics actually, in this age group, have lower total mortality. And Hispanics, that's the light blue line, way lower mortality. Liberals want to talk about, the left wants to talk about universal health care, which we still don't have. The UK has enjoyed universal health care for a really long time. We still have 20-odd million people with no health insurance at all. It's a big problem. Democrats have been working since 1948 trying to solve that problem. And then you have people saying, oh, but this group doesn't deserve attention. So this is the challenge before us, and this will be the subject of my next two lectures. Number one. How can we diffuse identity expressive discourse, which turns politics into zero-sum positional esteem competition? And number two, Once we diffuse this, we have to reconstruct democratic discourse in a positive direction around evidence-based policymaking to solve the problems that we face together, some of which are quite urgent, including climate change. So that challenge will be the subject of my next two lectures. Thank you.